G'day everyone, welcome back to Mastering Defence Infrastructure. I'm Darian Macy, joined, as always, by Jessica Bottlebrush. Jess, last week we covered Australia's efforts to bolster security infrastructure of our regional allies. This week, the shoe is on the other foot as we look at investments that support our principal ally, the US, operating within our borders.
Yeah, that's right, Darian. Today we're zeroing in on the US Force Posture Initiatives, USFPI, those joint projects reshaping supporting the United States military's posture in Northern Australia. Seriously, every time I go back up, there's more American kit arriving.
And the context for USFPI, well, it's strategic, right? This isn't just about shiny new runways or more Marines on the ground. Go back to 2011. Prime Minister Gillard and President Obama announced rotational US presence. Then the 2014 Force Posture Agreement. That's the legal backbone. It spells out how the US gets access, how the costs are split. But the key part, no matter who pays to build it, those facilities are still Australian property.
That sovereignty piece keeps cropping up, doesn't it? People ask about it at every industry briefing. It's clear. Our rules, our land, but shared access for combined activities. And the cost sharing, that's proportional to each side's use, not just a handout from one government or the other.
Exactly. USFPI started off as a Marine rotation at Darwin and Enhanced Air Cooperation. Lots of acronyms, sorry folks. But now it's gone wide. Land, maritime, logistics, and even space. All about deterrence and being able to work together, which, look, as we mentioned a few episodes back, is right in line with the AUKUS story too. It's about building an estate that supports allied operations, not just ours alone.
And all of that investment, well, it's not just symbolic. It's delivering hard infrastructure, like what we see up at Darwin, Tyndall, Robertson Barracks, Bradshaw. It's joint operations in action. Actually, a lot like we discussed on the AUKUS submarine episode. Only these projects are above ground and already changing how we train, deploy, and work with the US and our regional partners.
Yeah, and I mean, if there was ever a moment where the Indo-Pacific focus felt real, this is it. Let's take it to Darwin for a concrete example, Jess.
Right, so RAF Darwin's been an absolute hive of activity over the past 5 years. You've got this new aircraft maintenance support facility, finished in 2019, finally giving shade and serious servicing space for rotations. After that, the new aircraft apron, mess hall, modular living in accommodation. Massive jump in capacity for both our people and the US guys during dry season surges.
That fuel farm's a big one too. Nova NACAP joint venture built the $76 million bulk fuel storage, 11 tanks tying straight into the base hydrant system. And suddenly Darwin goes from, we can host a couple squadrons, to we can support 2,500 US Marines plus RAF assets for months at a time. The scale up is enormous.
I still remember seeing those big white tanks for the first time during NT Defence Week. They're hard to miss, and people finally feel like the infrastructure is catching up to equipment numbers. During Talisman Sabre, it was almost comical. You'd see KC-135 tankers, F-35Bs from the US Marines just, you know, sitting out there side by side with RAF growlers. I always talk about base morale, but infrastructure really does lift things. The routines, the culture, even the buzz in the mess at dinner time.
You're spot on. The expanded parking aprons. Now you can run integrated exercises without worrying about running out of space for heavy jets. Operations tempo for both allies, better disaster response. Everything from humanitarian drop-offs to pilot training gets that little bit easier.
And those investments at Darwin is not just about aircraft. It creates jobs locally, contracts for NT companies, like the modular accommodation blocks from Tiwi Partners. There's a multiplier effect in the community, which we sometimes underplay in infrastructure circles.
So Darwin's the gateway, but Tyndall, well, I'd argue it's Northern Australia's new power projection hub. Let's get into that. I reckon the Tyndall story's a perfect case study in how USFPI is rewriting the playbook. We're looking at $1.5 billion in airfield works with everything. Runway extensions, new aprons, power and water upgrades, extra security, you name it. That's all to get Tyndall ready for big hitters like the KC-30As, US bombers and heavy transports.
The scale is unreal. And then you've got the US chipping in with their own use $80 million bulk fuel farm under construction as we speak. I get asked a lot about what's all that fuel for? Well, supporting larger numbers of aircraft, longer range sorties, especially with the new plan for USB-52s to deploy regularly out of Tyndall. It's next level strategic reach.
Don't forget that earth-covered munitions magazine. Opened in 2022, finally a safe place to store the kind of ordnance you need for genuine, extended long-range missions. All of this is tied back to stronger joint operations, not just for a regional contingency, but for real, ongoing deterrence.
I mean, look at what's on the horizon. The B-52 apron and operations facility, expected to finish up by 2026. Six big bombers plus all the support facilities. If you'd mentioned this 10 years ago, people would have laughed. But now it's baked into the plans. So much so that sometimes you have to stop and ask, are we keeping up with the pace of change operationally?
Yeah, Tyndall's not just about the flying stuff either. The upgrades trigger supply chain activity down the Stuart. Catherine suddenly finds itself on procurement maps. It's not just an airbase in the bush anymore. It's a linchpin for Australia's northern air power posture.
And the flow on for industry is huge. But let's pivot. Land forces need upgrades too. Robertson Barracks, that's another textbook transformation. So at Robertson, the $389 million base improvements project, huge step up. New accommodation blocks, a mess and kitchen complex, gym, rec spaces, upgraded power and comms. The old buildings from the 90s just couldn't cut it with 2,000 plus US Marines every dry season, plus our own folks.
We talk a lot about world-class joint land forces base. This is what that means. They're setting Robertson up so it can absorb bigger Marine Rotational Force Darwin contingents. And it's scalable. Mess facilities, living in, the works. It means safer, healthier deployments and less operational disruption as rotations swing up or down.
From my side, I always found the environmental side interesting, let's say, at Robertson. Balancing heritage values with the sheer urgency of delivery, never simple. I remember the push-pull between the project managers and the heritage consultants. Can we get this kitchen complex approved before dry season? Yes, if you don't dig an extra car park near the old ammunition magazine. I use it as a case study in every training session now. The key is keeping heritage management up front, not an afterthought, as the clock ticks down toward each new Marine rotation.
I mean, that's the real-world tension in defence projects, right there. It's not just building for capability. It's navigating the intersection of legacy, environment, and tight windows for delivery. We saw similar issues back in Episode 7 when we talked about army modernisation. But here, the scale and urgency is dialed way up. And you can see the difference those upgrades make, not just for joint exercises, but for the whole future of co-location between our Army and US forces. Now, if you want to talk future-focused, let's get into Bradshaw and the absolute reinvention happening out there. All right, Bradshaw Field Training Area, $747 million in upgrades going in. Nakuru airstrip's been extended and sealed, so now C-17s and Ospreys can deliver troops and kit directly to the middle of nowhere. More parking bays for heavy aircraft, a new 250-person camp, medical center, plus an urban training zone, all at brigade exercise scale.
That's just game-changing. Instead of relying on slow overland supply or staging everything from major bases, now they can move big elements of troops, vehicles, medics, everything right onto the ground. Makes those big integrated live-fire exercises actually viable.
And look, the local participation's critical here too. CITSLA runs the managing contractor program, and Indigenous enterprise is actually at the heart of delivery, especially on country. That shift in approach, it's invaluable, not just for project outcomes, but for reconciliation and economic development in remote regions. I gotta admit, it makes me a bit nostalgic. Back in 2006, I wrote the business case for the first Nakuru upgrade with the US Army Corps of Engineers. At the time, they just wanted a dirt airstrip to test rapid construction methods before the Middle East deployments. Who could have guessed it'd turn into this linchpin for multinational operations nearly two decades later?
And the Urban Ops Training Complex? That's something I never expected to see at Bradshaw. Real buildings, legit urban scenarios, they'll train at a brigade level now, which opens up enormous training possibilities, not just for defence, but for allied forces rotating through.
It all feeds back to that theme. Integrated, scalable, real-world infrastructure with the local industry and traditional owners delivering the works. Gives us some confidence for future projects, but, you know, delivering all this, that's a science in itself.
Yeah, so let's get into the how. Because this is where a lot of listeners have questions. With so much activity, Defence uses those managing contractor models a lot. DPMC, the Defence Infrastructure Panel for Major Construction, came in to streamline big projects. If you're pre-qualified, it's a direct shot at the 200 million plus works, like those at Robertson and Tyndall.
And there's a dual track, right? When it's US funded, like Tyndall's fuel farm or that Darwin fuel tank project, delivery often goes through NAVFAC, the US Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command. Those tenders turn up on SAM.gov, which, and I always mix this up, is like the state's version of Austender in a way. Australian subs can still team up under US funded jobs, like Nova NACAP did for the fuel farms, or CC Pines did with SLS Co. for the RAF Darwin stuff.
Best advice, early engagement. Know your contractor panels, show up to defence briefings and get your DISP clearances sorted so you can actually pitch when tender rounds drop. And if you're not on a defence panel, partner with someone who is. No point sitting it out.
Absolutely. The local multiplier matters too, and it's not just about construction. It's high-value program management, environmental approvals, landscape architects, heritage, logistics. If you look at what's coming down the pipeline, future upgrades at RAF Curtin, Sherga, more USFPI stuff, there's work for years provided you're strategic about it.
And don't forget to jump on Austender for the Australian opportunities, but keep one eye on SAM.gov if US money's paying for the new works. That's how you find those NAV, FASI-led contracts. Next week, we'll actually swing south for our last episode of this course, digging into the Australia-Singapore Military Training Initiative, which honestly is a whole separate world of project delivery complexity.
Looking forward to that. Jess, thanks as always for your take. Great stories and actual on-the-ground experience. Thanks to our listeners for sticking with us through the weeds. If you've got follow-up questions or want to bounce ideas around, get in touch over DECNET. This is why we built the network. See you next time on Mastering Defence Infrastructure.
Thanks, Darian. And cheers, everyone. Hang in there for one more episode. It's a big one. Catch you soon.